This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
In South Korea, it's increasingly dangerous to be a feminist. I'm Jean McKenzie, and I'm exploring why young men are carrying out aggressive online witch hunts to try and get feminists fired from their jobs, and how this is silencing women.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Richtig spannend, richtig vielfältig. Das ist deine Karriere bei Kaufland. Ob Trainee-Programm, Direkteinstieg, Studentenjob oder Praktikum. Finde bei uns den Einstieg, der zu dir passt. Profitiere von einer attraktiven Vergütung, spannenden Aufgaben und individuellen Entwicklungsmöglichkeiten. Werde jetzt Teil unseres Teams. Bewirb dich jetzt unter kaufland.de/studenten. Kaufland, hier bin ich richtig.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. Coming up on the programme, we'll bring you the latest on the powerful earthquake which has struck the Tibet region of China, with rescuers searching now through the night for survivors in a remote and freezing region. More on that in 30 minutes. First, though, we're heading to France with two stories that have, in their own but perhaps linked ways, powerful symbolism. In a moment, the 10th anniversary commemorations of the Islamist gun attacks in Paris. And before that, the news that broke shortly before we came on air, that the far-right French politician Jean-Marie Le Pen has died. He was 96, a convicted racist and an anti-Semite, a man who was both seen as a pariah and yet whose influence and reach can still be felt today. Le Pen founded France's National Front Party in 1972. He came to international attention 30 years later when he led a surprise challenge for the presidency, reaching the second round, the runoff of the election, before losing heavily to Jacques Chirac. His daughter, Marine Le Pen, has both followed in his footsteps and also tried to distance herself from him. She renamed the party, calling it National Rally, and she succeeded in turning it into a major force in French politics. Here's Andrew Harding.
Vive la France nationale! Vive la France!
He was, for years, the most divisive figure in all of France. Jean-Marie Le Pen. His surname, like a bullet, ricocheting through French politics. Le Pen was born in rural obscurity, but he studied law and then became a soldier, fighting in the wars that marked the end of France's colonial empire. In the 1970s, Le Pen founded the extreme-right National Front.
Les nations ont cessé d'exister en tant que telles.
He was a brash, even thuggish populist, opposed to European integration and to large-scale immigration.
Je vais faire courir, moi, tu vas voir le rouquin là-bas. Pédé!
You can hear Le Pen here shouting crude insults at one protester. And coming close to blows here with a socialist critic, a woman. But it was his views about the past that provoked the most outrage. He defended France's wartime collaboration with the Nazis and described the gas chambers and genocide of 6 million Jews as a detail of history. Even Le Pen's close advisor, Bruno Gollnisch, winced at that.
I consider that it was a mistake, but it's absolutely ridiculous to reduce the work of such a statesman whose speeches, analyses, books, it covers maybe 30 or 40,000 pages. And to reduce to this only words, absolutely, absolutely ridiculous.
In the 1980s, Le Pen began inching closer to serious political power. And finally, in 2002, he shocked France by getting through to a second round runoff for the presidency itself.
Énorme surprise, Jean-Marie Le Pen semble...
It was Le Pen's political peak.
I am ready to win. If the French people want, win also.
Instead, Le Pen lost heavily, many French uniting against him in disgust. And soon, he would be eclipsed by his own daughter, Marine Le Pen.
Vive le Front National!
She took over the National Front and sought to soften slightly its image, eventually expelling her father in the process. He felt betrayed. It's a crime, he declared here, saying he was ashamed that his daughter carried his surname. But later, the two patched things up. History may well nudge Jean-Marie Le Pen to the sidelines, too extreme, too much the maverick for French tastes. But his name lives on, and so do many of his beliefs, reshaped by his daughter, the Le Pens, still challenging and reshaping French politics.
That was our Paris correspondent Andrew Harding reporting. Well, joining me now is Gilles Mihaly. He's an historian and journalist with the conservative magazine Causeur. Gilles, very good to have you on the programme. I guess that question that Andrew ended with is where I want to start, which is, you know, whether you think that he is going to be seen ultimately as this rather marginal figure because of his some of his very toxic views, or whether you think he has had a real effect in terms of shaping French politics.
I think he had a great effect. First of all, his extreme political longevity. I mean, he was elected to the French National Assembly in the mid-50s, 70 years ago, and never left the political and public scene since. So he became a kind of a monument. And then there's something much deeper, because he was a pivotal figure in recycling far-right ideologies with roots in pre-World War II Europe into what we see today as mainstream politics, contemporary populist conservatism in France, but also in Holland, in Great Britain, Italy, Hungary, one might even say the United States. In France, it wasn't only about bridging over decades with ideas. It was also about recycling and legitimizing people. When he started 50, 60 years ago, around him were people who were collaborators with the Pétain regime in France. There were even members of the SS. So he recycled people, he recycled ideas, he recycled structures.
When you say recycled, is this another way of saying he legitimized? Because obviously it's very difficult to consider Jean-Marie Le Pen without thinking about some of the frankly awful things that he said about Jews, about the inequality of the races as far as he saw it, about the record of the Nazis in France.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was a man of his time in the 60s, 70s, but also in the 90s and in the beginning of the 21st century. He lived this passage from one ideological world of the 30s, 40s, 50s into the other. And when he couldn't evolve anymore, his daughter just brutally cut him off 10, 12 years ago. And she kept the movement because economically he was a Thatcherist, and he was one of the first people who said that uncontrolled immigration from African states, countries, is a problem. Today, it's almost mainstream to be liberal in economics and to say that we have a problem with immigration. So he has that too. And he also structured French political life because it was clear very early to the Social Democrats that he's not after power. He wanted just to be around, but he didn't really threaten them. That made him the perfect political enemy. And Mitterrand turned him into a kind of a caricature of the devil. And for about 20 or 30 years, political debate in France was, are you with Le Pen or are you vote to those who are against him?
Indeed.
So he really played a very important role.
Gilles, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us. Well, on to that other big story I mentioned out of France today. It is 10 years to the day since the rampage by two Islamist gunmen. They were brothers at the Paris office of the satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo after it had published caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. Altogether, 12 people were killed by the brothers, including several cartoonists and a Muslim policeman who was on duty outside. That same day, another armed Islamist killed 4 Jews as he took hostages at a kosher supermarket in Paris. Today, the French President Emmanuel Macron took part in commemorations marking the bloody events of the 7th of January 2015. These Parisians said there were still lessons to learn from that terrible day.
I feel a lot of emotion because I remember everything. Was somewhat forgotten all about freedom of expression, and I do think that there's a little bit too much political correctness now.
Honestly, I don't think there's been a huge step forward. I think that in terms of freedom of expression, there are a lot of things that are still censored.
A couple of voices from Paris today. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield, well, he was covering events for us that day 10 years ago, and he's covering the commemorations today. Hugh, what has been the tenor of the events?
Well, quite low-key, really, small-scale, but televised. Macron, his wife, the Prime Minister, the former President, François Hollande, all there paying their respects. And going from place to place, the three key places were the offices of Charlie Hebdo, of course, the place where the Muslim policeman was killed as the Qureshi brothers escaped, and then the other place, the Jewish supermarket, where 2 days later, the Koulibaly killed the hostages, the four Jews. So, I mean, you know, very low key, but with this sense that this is a 10th anniversary. They've been, you know, it's been commemorated every year, but this is the 10th anniversary, so it is a kind of moment to look back and think hard on what happened then and what's happened in between.
And of course, Charlie Hebdo, I mean, it has always stood for freedom of expression. It, I mean, in many people's eyes, in a puerile, offensive way, but the question is whether people still feel in France as strongly as they did 10 years ago. I mean, that we're all Charlie Hebdo. That was the great chant, wasn't it? Mm. I mean, do you think that sense that freedom of expression is sacrosanct remains strong in France?
No, I think things have changed. I think everyone agrees in principle with the idea of freedom of expression. So, you know, you have a poll, you'll get all the right answers. But I think things have changed. I mean, quite obviously, it is no longer possible to do what Charlie Hebdo did. I mean, Charlie Hebdo, you've got to remember, deeply anti-clerical and for years published shocking images related to Christianity, which, you know, I couldn't even describe on the radio now because they were so offensive. But it couldn't do that now regarding Islam. It would just be absolutely impossible. No one would touch it. It's too dangerous. So that is now a fact of life. The second thing that's happened, I think it's true, is that the mentality that my generation grew up with, 20, 30 years ago, which consisted of saying that, you know, here in the West, you can say what you like, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me and images won't hurt me either. That's gone. And a new generation is growing up, and the polls bear this out, younger people who feel far more nuanced about all of this and who will say, well, hang on a sec, those caricatures, those cartoons, they were offensive, and that, you know, you can't just gratuitously, as they would see it, poke fun at religions in the multicultural world in which we live today. So, you know, the world has changed.
Hugh Schofield, our correspondent in Paris, thank you very much for joining us. And Hugh has written a piece reflecting on 10 years since the events of January the 7th, 2015, when 12 people were killed by those brothers in the Charlie Hebdo attack. And then also there was the attack on the kosher supermarket in Paris, which led to the killing of 4 Jews. You can see that online, bbc.com/news. This is NewsHour. And coming up on the programme, if you take alcohol out of wine, it might be healthy, but is it wine? We speak to the Italians helping classify non-alcoholic wine as wine.
The drink comes from the wine. So the wine that has a 13-14% of alcohol, which you de-alcoholized. So you bring a product to 0.5% of alcohol. It's not a grape juice.
That interview coming up in the second half of our programme, along with this headline, which we'll be exploring in much more detail. A powerful earthquake has killed More than 100 people in Tibet and wrecked the Buddhist holy city of Shigatse. And the other headline this hour, as we've been hearing, the French far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen has died at the age of 96. You're with NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. In South Korea, it's now considered dangerous to be seen as a feminist. The backlash to women's rights has become so fierce that those who advocate for gender equality are accused of being man-haters and face severe consequences. Online, young men hunt down women they even suspect of having feminist views. They try to get them fired from their jobs. And this online violence has spilled into real life. It's left women too scared to admit they are feminists, as our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie has been finding out.
Can you show me some of the abusive messages that you received?
Some say goodbye. Another says you must be pretty comfortable with your life because you've sabotaged your job. You're drinking poison, and if you keep drinking it, you will die.
We're calling this woman Doreen. She draws animations for video games. And one night, after completing a big project for one of Korea's most popular games, Maple Story, she was flooded with these abusive messages.
Others say, your mum is a cripple. And there are swear words I'd never heard before. I was so shocked.
Doreen had become the target of a vicious online witch hunt where young men try to get feminists fired from their jobs. They often target women who work in the gaming industry, trawling their social media to find any trace of feminism, then pressuring their companies to sack them. And way back on Doreen's timeline, they'd found a supportive post.
People started filing complaints to the Maple Story team. This person is a feminist, they said. My company and the CEO, we were all in a panic. There were so many complaints by people wanting me to be fired.
This backlash to feminism has been slowly escalating. Women here suffer from severe discrimination, misogyny, and sexual violence. And as feminists have fought to improve women's rights, young men have pushed back.
It's so bad. It's worse than I remember. Good God.
Can you read me some of the messages?
Okay. Korean women are spreading poison in the well. It's all just general misogyny.
I'm sitting with Min-Sung Kim. He's a big online gamer, and we're looking through some popular online message boards, and they're just full of misogynistic abuse. Min-Sung used to belong to these forums, but now he calls himself an ardent feminist, and he's working to support women who are being attacked. He even managed to convince Doreen's company not to fire her. Why do these men have such a problem with feminists?
By their alternate reality, men are actually being systematically repressed, being systematically discriminated against. Feminists just want to take away men's rights. They're confident now that when you accuse someone of feminism, you can ruin their career.
Because these witch hunts do work. There are cases where women have lost their jobs. And for one woman, the violence spilled offline and into real life. We're calling her Chigu.
He exploded and started banging on the counter with his hand and throwing things at me. He said, hey, you're a feminist, right? You look like a feminist with your short hair.
Chigu was working alone in a convenience store late at night when the man came in and started attacking her.
He grabbed my arm and pushed me very hard against the shelves. Then he pushed me down to the ground and started punching my face and kicking my body so I wouldn't be able to get up. He said, I never hit women. I've never even hit my mum. But feminists need to get beaten. I kept going in and out of consciousness, and at some point, he picked me up and threw me. I thought I could die.
Chigu has been left with permanent injuries, and her attack has frightened women here. Many are now too scared to admit they're feminists, or even cut their hair short in case they're attacked. Chinsook Park is the head of South Korea's Women's Party.
Women in South Korea right now don't have freedom of speech, also don't have freedom of thinking, because they were highly threatened about what kind of belief they have. Right now, we cannot even choose the length of our hair. And that's so weird. That's just nonsense, right?
That report from Seoul from our correspondent, Jean McKenzie. It might seem like a bit of a throwback to a rather ancient form of diplomacy, but the King of Denmark has, as one newspaper put it today, shocked some historians by changing his royal coat of arms. Essentially, fewer lions and crowns, more prominent, bigger polar bear and ram, symbolising Greenland and the Faroe Islands, and it's widely being interpreted symbolising a back the heck off to those who may want independence for those territories, or, more to the point, might want to annex those territories. This in the context of Donald Trump declaring the ownership of Greenland an absolute necessity to the US and his son Don Jr. making a trip today to Greenland. Mark Jacobson is Associate Professor of Arctic Diplomacy and Security Politics at the Royal Danish Defence College. How much concern is there in Denmark about losing both territories?
Both the Faroe Islands and especially Greenland are on the road towards independence or enhanced self-determination. Until now, it's mostly got political attention. But I think this is an interesting detail that the royal family is more direct in that they want, depending on the perspective, one perspective could be that it's a sign of respect to see Greenland and the Faroe Islands as more equal parts of the kingdom. Another perspective would be that it's an attempt to keep them within the kingdom and the realm. But if I can bring up another example, King Frederick and Queen Mary, they have several children, but they're twins. They have four names, and one of them is Greenlandic. The girl is also named Ivalo, and the boy is named Minik. When they visited Greenland this summer, everybody in Greenland, they called them Ivalo and Minik, Ivalo and Minik. And it was very clear that the warm feelings that Greenlanders have, especially towards the royal family in Denmark, it means a lot in Greenland. And it also means a lot for when politicians and others will show what it means to both Denmark, Greenland and Faroe Islands, that it's important to maintain the realm as it is.
It's really interesting what you're saying about the sort of the role the royal family is taking here. And in a sense, I mean, it has a certain political symbolism, certainly what's being done with the coat of arms. Do you think there is a fairly strong unanimity of feeling in Denmark, particularly about the status of Greenland?
Well, unfortunately, that's not that much focus on Greenland and Faroe Islands in Denmark. But I think both the change of coat of arms, if it gets more attention, but also in another perspective, Trump's idea of purchasing Greenland, it kind of adds up. So it fuels the debate in Denmark. It brings more attention to what it means to have a realm, what it means to be an Arctic state. And it's very important to have that discussion. Is it in the Danes' interest to maintain the realm as it is? Or would it be fine for Denmark also if Greenland and the Faroe Islands become independent?
And just, I mean, the view today, you said there's a lot of coverage of Don Jr.'s visit to Greenland. Is it sort of with a certain amused attachment, or is there actually real concern that his dad has said Greenland becoming American is an absolute necessity?
In 2019, when he first shared his idea, there was more amusement than there is today. Today, people are not laughing that much anymore, thinking about, well, this is not really a way to treat close allies. Is this really what Greenland wants, to replace dependency on Denmark with dependency on the US? It's seen as too aggressive. But we will see how it develops.
And that was Mark Jacobson, Associate Professor of Arctic Diplomacy and Security Policies at the Royal Danish Defence College, talking about that change in the royal coat of arms in Denmark. You're listening to NewsHour. Much more to come in the next 30 minutes. Stay with us if you can.
What do Tiger Woods, Mark Zuckerberg and Taylor Swift all have in common? Well, their lives and fortunes are all being discussed on Good Bad Billionaire, the podcast exploring the minds, motives and the money of some of the world's wealthiest individuals. I'm Xing Xing, and each week my co-presenter Simon Jack and I take a closer look at the world's mega rich, and we try to decide whether they're good, bad or just another billionaire. From celebs and CEOs to sports stars and tech titans, find out how billionaires made their money and how they use it. Good Bad Billionaire from the BBC World Service. All episodes of season 1 and 2 are available now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And click follow or subscribe so you never miss a new episode.
Richtig spannend, richtig vielfältig. Das ist deine Karriere bei Kaufland. Ob Trainee-Programm, Direkteinstieg, Studentenjob oder Praktikum. Finde bei uns den Einstieg, der zu dir passt. Profitiere von einer attraktiven Vergütung, spannenden Aufgaben und individuellen Entwicklungsmöglichkeiten. Werde jetzt Teil unseres Teams. Bewirb dich jetzt unter kaufland.de/studenten. Kaufland, hier bin ich richtig.
Welcome back to NewsHour. It's just been a very stressful time in India, it always is around now, with the annual civil service examinations and the chance to secure a coveted job in government. Students in the state of Bihar have been protesting for weeks, claiming that there were irregularities in the tests, from where the BBC's Archana Shukla reports.
I'm in Patna and it's early morning on the banks of River Ganga. About 100 students, all in the age group of 18 to 25, are giving a mock test. They are preparing for competitive exams in hopes of a good government job. That's the teacher reading out the right answers and students are marking themselves on the multiple choice questionnaire. It's one of the most extraordinary sights. Most of them cannot afford private training centers and hence have made this public promenade their classroom. They are desperate. Government exams are their only shot at a stable career and they try year after year. But their dreams are crushed each time by cheating scandals and frauds where question papers are leaked for money. 25-year-old Akash Kumar, a graduate, works by day and studies for a police recruitment exam by night. But in the last 2 years, papers were leaked and exams cancelled.
If paper leaks keep happening, poor students will never be able to realize their dreams of becoming officers. My father works as a construction worker, but hopes I will get a government job so my family doesn't struggle for daily wages anymore.
Competition is fierce. Millions are vying for a few thousand government jobs. Hundreds of miles away, a sleepy village in Uttar Pradesh bears testimony. In a quiet house, Lakshman Pal Singh sits, grieving. His 26-year-old son struggled to find a secure job for years. Last February, he was one of around 5 million who took an exam to fill 60,000 constable posts. But exams were leaked again.
After the paper leak, I consoled him and told him it's okay, but he was shattered. The next morning, he took his life. He had burned all his college certificates. He said his degrees were useless if they can't get him a job. Our only hope is gone. What do we look forward to?
In 2024 alone, 6 major exams were compromised and nearly 10 million students left in the lurch. Enraged, the students have been protesting across the country. As pressure mounted, the government, first dismissive of any failure, has promised reforms. India's education minister Dharmendra Pradhan told reporters in December the overhaul could be slow but sure to minimize irregularities. Back in Patna, these students still keep trying. After all, the dream of a better life is all they have to hold on to.
And that was Archana Shukla reporting from Bihar. You with the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. We're heading now to one of the more remote parts of the world and one where it's long been very difficult as journalists to get access to. It's the Tibet region of China, where a powerful earthquake has struck. Officials say more than 100 people have been killed. Hundreds of buildings have been destroyed. State media are reporting that although some distance from the epicentre, many houses have collapsed around the historic city of Shigatse, a site of great holiness for Tibetan Buddhists. This is how a news anchor from China's state broadcaster, CCTV, broke the story.
Let's look at the latest news. According to the China Earthquake Network Center, an earthquake of around magnitude 6.9 occurred today at 9.05 a.m. near the Tingri County, Shigaze City, Tibet. The final result will be based on the official report.
Well, that magnitude has since been increased to 7.1, and as often happens, there's also been a series of powerful aftershocks. Video posted to social media shows people fleeing a shop where products are raining down from the shelves. Buildings with walls sheared off, rescue workers clambering over rubble to listen for voices buried within and trying to pull heavy debris away with just their gloved hands. No sign, at least on the footage we've seen so far, of heavy machinery on site. The quake and aftershocks have been felt in the capitals of Nepal and Bhutan and in northern India. Ekdev Adhikari, who leads the National Emergency Operations Centre in Nepal, said a rescue operation was underway.
Immediately after the earthquake, we activated our emergency response protocol. My team now is assessing the situation, and coordination was established with the local authorities, first responders. But we have the difficulty of the rock terrain, highest Himalayan terrain, including some of the world's highest peaks. And this time is winter season. So the temperature is also freezing.
We'll hear from our correspondent in Nepal in just a moment. But first to our correspondent in Beijing, Laura Bicker. Laura, it's late night now in Beijing. What's the latest that you're picking up?
Well, we've just had an update on the death toll. 126 people have now died, with more than 188 injured. 28 critically injured people have been transferred to other hospitals for treatment. Now, we're hearing that thousands of households have had their homes collapse. We've seen images coming on state media. We're monitoring it here in Beijing because, as you've mentioned, we would need special permission from the government as foreign journalists to enter Tibet. So we've seen, and we're monitoring Chinese state media, where we've seen rescuers who have been swift on the scene. They are going house to house, which these are low built mountain homes. They've just simply collapsed at the strength of this quake. They are pulling bodies from the rubble. They are pulling some survivors. We've seen a lot of elderly and a lot of young people cradled within the rubble and also being treated on site. The army have also arrived on scene. They've erected tents. Now, I can't emphasise the freezing temperatures enough because we've just heard that it's now minus 18 Celsius in this region with no shelter. They are trying to put up tents. They are trying to make sure that there's some heat going to those who have no homes overnight. But this is going to be a major rescue effort for days to come.
It is a remote region. Obviously, as you've said, it's one that is very difficult to get access to and get precise information on. It is also noted, though, for being prone to earthquakes. Does that mean that there are precautions taken in terms of building standards, or is it just simply sort of too poor an area, really, to have that sort of thing?
Well, I think this is the strongest quake they've had in 5 years. It is prone to quakes. It does sit on the fault line. But these are buildings that have managed to cope during other quakes. This has been a particularly strong and particularly shallow earthquake that has hit this very, very remote region. And many of these people, when you look at the area, so the Chinese Air Force have launched a drone, an unmanned drone, to try to direct rescue efforts from the air, mostly because the roads themselves, when you see pictures coming in, the roads have just cracked. They're totally split after the ground shook. So they're using these drones, and from the air, you get a better idea, better sense. These are remote communities, small villages that are over a vast area. And the houses look like small farmhouses that have collapsed. So I would imagine that, yes, some of them have withstood earthquakes in the past, but this certainly has been the strongest quake they've seen in this region in 5 years.
And in terms of the response from the authorities in Beijing, I mean, it would be a tough rescue operation wherever. But how far is it sort of seen as a bit of a test of central authority, this type of terrible accident?
Well, President Xi has issued instructions. He was pretty swift at issuing those instructions. He's told rescue teams to minimize casualties. He's told rescue teams and the army to make sure that they get shelter for those who need it, and to get hospital treatment to ensure that everybody who needs help gets it. So those are the instructions coming from central government. What we've seen from state media on the ground is that that action has been swift. We have seen a number of personnel.
Okay. Laura, thank you very much for bringing us the latest live from Beijing. Well, as I mentioned, the quake was felt strongly in Nepal, indeed several hundred kilometres from the epicentre. In the capital, Kathmandu, among those shaken by the tremors was our own Sanjay Dakal. He's a senior journalist with the BBC Nepali service.
Although Kathmandu is quite far away from the epicenter, could feel it quite strongly, in fact. It was early in the morning, 10 minutes to 7 o'clock, so I was just awake, and I felt it quite strongly. My wife was in the kitchen, my kids were sleeping, I had to wake them up, and I could hear my neighbors shout, so we just tried to get out of the house, but by that time, the earthquake, it stopped. But we could see trees swaying and my flower pots shaking. We could feel it quite strongly.
Right. Well, given that it is some distance away from where the epicenter was, it suggests that this was really a strong earthquake. And of course, in Nepal, there are, real strong memories of the terrible quake of 10 years ago.
Right. In 2015, there was a big earthquake, as you know. Every time when there is a strong earthquake, these memories all come rushing back to us, and we become even more frightened, all of the people around this country. So this memory when 2015 earthquake hit us, it had killed almost 9,000 people and destroyed thousands of houses, and some of the reconstruction is still going on. So there is a lot of memories about earthquake, and every time there's an earthquake, they all come rushing back.
Sanjay, given the geography and you feeling the earthquake in Kathmandu, I guess there must be more concern about eastern Nepal and where, I don't know if it is mountaineering season right now, but a lot of people do go to climb the mountains in that region. Do we get, do we know any news from there? Have we got any reports from there?
Not exactly. Till this evening, there's no report of any major casualties in Nepal, whether in Kathmandu or in the regions that you are referring to, the mountainous regions. The spring season is yet to begin this year, so there will be very few tourists, if any. And this region in mountain region, actually the Everest region, was quite close to the epicenter, much closer than Kathmandu from the epicenter. But then there were no such reports, except some sporadic reports of some houses being damaged somewhere. No human casualty has been reported so far.
And that was Sanjay Dakal from the BBC Nepali service in Kathmandu. Well, as we've been hearing it, this is an area of profound importance to Tibetan Buddhists. Sikong Penpa Tsering is the leader of the Tibetan government in exile. He spoke to me from Dharamsala in eastern India. He told me about the cultural and religious significance of the region.
The Shigatse is the second largest township or the city in Tibet, next to the capital Lhasa. So till the 5th Dalai Lama, Shigatse was the center of power of the kings who ruled Tibet. And Shigatse later became the seats of the successive Panchen Lamas, who had administrative control in the whole area. Sakya is also home to the Sakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. So most of the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism originated from these areas in central Tibet, where the earthquake had struck. So it has a lot of religious and architectural significance for the Tibetans historically.
Right. Presumably there are some very old monasteries there.
Yes. Most of the central monasteries of all the traditions lie in that area.
You must be concerned that those buildings, the older buildings, maybe the taller buildings as well, that they are likely to be more vulnerable in an earthquake such as this.
Definitely. We still don't know the extent of damage it has done to buildings, so we'll have to wait for some more time to get images out of Tibet, because every one of us know that it is very difficult to get information out of Tibet, including images of disasters like this. So hopefully, we are already counting 95 dead and 130 injured as of 3 o'clock in the afternoon of China's time. But there has been no update since then.
And I guess you must be concerned that when it comes to the rebuilding of this area, if there is damage to parts that are culturally or religiously significant, that you would want them to be looked after in a way that is sensitive. But I mean, the record of the Chinese government has not always been that way, has it?
Now we'll have to see how Chinese government reacts to rebuilding and reconstruction of the destroyed properties, and particularly, as you mentioned, the old monasteries and manuscripts and murals that has been impacted. So the other angle is also that we all know that Chinese government has announced the construction of a mega dam on the bend of the Brahmaputra. And I think this is a signal to the Chinese government also to take into consideration the environmental impact of mega developmental projects inside Tibet without taking into consideration the interests of the downstream countries. So we all know that the Tibetan plateau has emerged out of the tectonic shift between the Indian plate and the Eurasian plate. And it's the geologists say that the Himalayas is still rising by 10 millimeter every year. And if something happens to that size of a dam that China is planning to build at this place called the Great Bend, then it's going to be catastrophic, for downstream countries. So this is, I think, a signal to everybody concerned in the region that there should be a lot of care that needs to be taken for the fragile Tibetan environment that will not only impact Tibet, but the whole region and perhaps globally.
And that was Sikong Penpa Tsering, leader of the Tibetan government in exile, speaking to me from Dharamsala in eastern India. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. The US military has sent 11 Yemeni prisoners from the Guantanamo Bay detention camp to Amman, leaving only 15 detainees still incarcerated. None of those freed on Monday had been charged with any crime during their 2 decades in the facility. Carol Rosenberg is a reporter for the New York Times who's covered Guantanamo Bay since the first detainees were brought there in 2002 and joins us from Guantanamo. Carol, who are these men, and what do we know about the circumstances of their release?
The men who departed yesterday morning were all Yemeni citizens who had been gathered up primarily in Pakistan or on the border with Afghanistan, fleeing the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after the September 11th attacks. Some of them would have been profiled by the United States as at best foot soldiers in the jihad, somehow associated with Al-Qaeda at best, but none of them were linked to ever accused of committing war crimes, and none of them were ever charged. They're Yemeni, and the U.S. forbids the return of Guantanamo detainees by law to Yemen because of the civil war there. And Oman, their neighbor, quite peaceful and a key player in Middle East diplomacy, agreed to take them into a rehabilitation program they have that had previously taken in 30 Guantanamo detainees. Some of these men, at least one that I can think of, were snatched and grabbed and turned over to the U.S. intelligence outside the Pakistan-Afghan region. But and some of them were profiled early on as suspected insiders of Al-Qaeda. But as I said, in the end, none were charged. And if anything, they've likely aged out of being certainly a tactical threat. You know, they spent more than 20 years at Guantanamo.
Yeah.
The Al-Qaeda has moved on, and they were never considered the leadership.
And Carol, I think this is probably about the 15th time I've asked you this question over the years from Guantanamo, but we're now down to 15 detainees left. I mean, is there any prospect, especially with Donald Trump due to take over in the White House within a couple of weeks, you know, for there to be a complete shutdown of the facility?
Well, that is really in the control of the U.S. Congress, because all administrations since Barack Obama have concluded that closing Guantanamo meant moving some aspect of Guantanamo north and taking some of the prisoners, particularly any of those convicted of war crimes, to the United States and putting them in a military-style detention up there because they're not classic federal prisoners convicted in federal court. But Congress forbids any of these men to set foot on U.S. soil and any administration to, you know, set up a facility. If Donald Trump can persuade Congress that it's a responsible, cheaper, more effective way to do it, they lift the embargo on transfer, and they could move some of these 15 men to a small facility somewhere in the U.S. Safely. Closing Guantanamo means retaining a few of these prisoners who are considered the worst of the worst and detaining them continuously.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Carol, thank you very much indeed for joining us from Guantanamo. Carol Rosenberg for the New York Times. Governments have all sorts of difficult decisions to make about all sorts of issues. For the Italian government, and in particular its agriculture minister, that's just involved defining wine. Francesco Lollobrigida has decided that low-alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks made from grapes can now be marketed as wine. He had previously been among those, including many traditional wine producers, who had said that de-alcoholized wine was a contradiction in terms. Paolo Paffi is with Casa Emma. It's a vineyard in Tuscany. How had they first decided to produce non-alcoholic wine?
When we decided to try to de-alcoholize the wine, it was an idea that was born in 2018. This idea was given by the owner of Casa Emma, that is called is Mr. Alessandro Bucalossi, which is a very good wine producer, but is also is an hematologist, is a medical doctor, and he knows very well that the alcohol is not so healthy sometimes. So we start to think how to de-alcoholize, and after 2 years of study and researches, we did our first batch of alcohol-free wines.
Yeah, and there are some people, I mean, undoubtedly, it's good if people drink less alcohol. I think everybody can agree with that. But there are some people who say that's a good thing, but this low alcohol or de-alcoholized non-alcoholic wine is not wine. It's another drink.
But the drink comes from the wine. So the wine that has a 13, 14% of alcohol, which you de-alcoholized. So you bring a product to 0.5% of alcohol.
Yeah, I guess the question, though, is whether it should be described as wine.
It's not a grape juice. That is the...
Understood. Understood.
It's not a grape juice.
Yeah. And how popular is it in Italy and with the market that you're serving? Because obviously you have a fantastic tradition of Chianti where you come from. I mean, are people open to the idea of this de-alcoholized wine?
Yeah, especially in Europe and the United States, the alcohol-free wine is going very, very well. In Italy, we are starting now. The new generation is asking for an alternative drink. And Italy now, also the company, the distributors is looking for an alcohol-free product. Wine, beer. So beer is already in the market since 5 years in Italy with alcohol-free.
Give me your honest opinion, Paolo. I mean, it doesn't taste quite the same as wine, does it?
We are trying our best to try that the taste is the same. What is the problem in wine? Because you start from 14% of alcohol. And when you take out 14% to a product, you take out in a big part. The taste, it's similar, but it's not exactly the same how should be a beer, for example.
Right. No? And is that why it's more difficult to do than beer, because of the higher alcohol content?
Exactly. But technologies is doing a very good job. Now, especially on the white wine, I tasted an excellent white.
Do you drink it?
Sometimes, yes. I drink wine, obviously, because yes. I produce wine. But when I cannot drink, especially because I have to drive, instead to drink a good glass of water, I prefer to drink a good glass of zero.
And that was Paolo Paffi from Casa Emma on the case for non-alcoholic wine and why it should be called wine. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.